If former President Donald Trump wins this year's presidential race, Senator J.D. Vance would become vice president, leaving an empty Senate seat to be filled. Today on the Cincinnati Edition Weekly News Review, we're going to discuss what Ohio Governor Mike DeWine is looking for in someone to appoint to that seat. We'll also hear about what Cincinnati's mayor is saying about a potential income tax increase, and we'll talk about an Olympian with Cincinnati roots who made history at the Paris Games 100 years ago. Joining me now to kick off the program is Ohio Public Media Statehouse News Bureau correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Welcome back, Sarah.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Always great to have you on the program. Sarah, as I mentioned, Senator J.D. Vance, he's on the Republican ticket as former President Trump's vice presidential pick. If Republicans do win the presidency, that would leave an open Senate seat in Ohio. It'd be up to Governor Mike DeWine to fill it, right?
Yeah, that's right. So basically the process is Governor Mike DeWine would choose the replacement for J.D. Vance because right now he does not have to resign his Senate seat while he's running on the ticket with Trump. He'd only have to resign if Trump and Vance win in the fall. So if that happens, Governor DeWine would pick his replacement through 2026, and then there would be a special election in 2026 to determine if that person gets to keep the seat or if someone else takes the seat. And then that would finish out Senator Vance's term through 2028. So it would kind of be a period of time. I mean, U.S. senators usually only have to run every 6 years, but whoever would be chosen to fill this seat would have to run several times to retain the seat before they'd get a full 6-year term.
What does Governor DeWine say he's looking for in someone to appoint to the seat if Senator Vance does become the next vice president?
He's not naming names, as myself and other outlets have reported, but he has been kind of revealing some of the criteria that he's thinking about. Governor DeWine himself served in the U.S. Senate before Sherrod Brown actually beat him out about a decade ago. And he says that he feels really strongly, Governor DeWine feels really strongly, that he wants someone in the seat who really knows Ohio and who really wants to serve in the Senate. He made a comment at the Ohio State Fair about a week ago that to Governor DeWine, it's not about someone who gets hits on talk television, on national television. It's about someone who really cares about Ohio and Ohio's interests and about someone who's committed to the Senate and not just looking at this Senate seat as something to put on their resume.
I know you said the governor's not naming names, but certainly some names have surfaced. What are the names floating around for this?
Absolutely. As soon as Vance was announced as Trump's vice presidential nominee pick, and even before, I mean, I think politicos were circulating names. Who would DeWine name? And there's kind of a couple of buckets that potential people fall into. So the first is people who DeWine has endorsed for different offices who are seen as maybe a little bit more establishment Republican. A name that comes to mind there is State Senator Matt Dolan from the Cleveland area, from Northeast Ohio. He, as you may remember, ran for the Senate primary nomination against Bernie Moreno and Frank LaRose earlier this year. He did not win, but Governor DeWine actually weighed in on the primary and endorsed Dolan over Moreno. So he's seen as one of the potential candidates if there were to be a vacancy. Of course, another name is Bernie Moreno. If Bernie Moreno loses and Sherrod Brown retains his seat, but Trump wins the presidency, there's a potential that Bernie Moreno could still be named to the Senate in that case. Vivek Ramaswamy's name has come up. He is seen as more of a firebrand conservative. He obviously is from Columbus, ran for president this time around, and then dropped out. He's a big Trump supporter, seen as a lot more conservative. So, I mean, you've heard Lieutenant Governor John Husted's name, Attorney General Dave Yost's name, Chair Jane Timken's name. I mean, there really is a list, but DeWine maintains he doesn't have a short list and he doesn't even have a long list right now. But people, including potential candidates and people who have their favorite, have certainly reached out to the governor.
That's interesting because Senator Matt Dolan, he has not been a big Trump supporter, right?
Notably, he hasn't. He says he is supportive of the Trump agenda and what Trump has gotten done. But, you know, when you saw Bernie Moreno and Secretary of State Frank LaRose really duking it out for the Trump endorsement, and of course, Bernie Moreno ended up getting that Trump endorsement, Matt Dolan wasn't actively seeking it. He does not paint himself as a big Trump supporter.
Are there statewide elected office holders who might be tapped for the job? You mentioned Secretary of State Frank LaRose. There are a bunch of Republicans in holding statewide office right now.
Absolutely. I think that's a potential place that Governor DeWine could look. And, you know, it's very likely that DeWine is going to retire from public office after this. He's at his limit in the governor's office. So this is likely, you know, this is his last term as governor. And the potential replacements for that role in 2026 right now have been seen as Lieutenant Governor John Husted and Attorney General Dave Yost. They're likely to challenge each other for the governor's seat. So there's a potential that DeWine names one of them to the Senate seat to kind of free up the governor's race and free up the Republican primary for the governor's race.
Okay. Well, let's talk about more turf, but not the political kind, the grass kind. Tell us about this bill related to synthetic turf.
Absolutely. So it was introduced earlier this year by a Republican representative and a Democratic representative in the House, and they want to push professional sports teams, so professional football teams with the NFL, professional soccer teams with MLS, and professional baseball teams with MLB to switch the surface of their fields from synthetic turf to natural grass. They say that the reasoning behind this is you see higher rates of non-contact lower extremity injuries like, you know, Achilles tears on fields that have synthetic turf. But it's really interesting, as I'm sure we're going to talk about, because there are very few teams that fit the bill for this very specific proposal. All of the MLB teams in Ohio, the Reds and the Guardians, they already have natural grass. Most MLB teams, period, have natural grass on their fields, as do the MLS teams in Ohio. And the Cleveland Browns play on natural grass. So if you're doing the math, there's really only one team that would be affected by this, and it's the Cincinnati Bengals.
Yes, the Bengals play Paycor Stadium. That's the big exception. And the team just installed new artificial turf, right? What did the team have to say about this bill?
So they said in a pretty short statement just that they were aware of the bill and that they were monitoring it. And I don't think they'll weigh in unless this bill moves further, because I should note at this point in the year, I'm going to be saying it a lot, we're nearing the end of the General Assembly's session. All of the bills that don't make it to the governor's desk essentially die in December and they'd have to be reintroduced. So the fact that these lawmakers are introducing it now kind of signals that they're just trying to get it out there and get a conversation happening. So I think the Bengals will keep what they're thinking closer to their chest unless the bill moves further. But they would be directly impacted by it, like you said, and they literally just replaced the synthetic turf in February, yeah. I think.
You talked with a representative from the NFL Players Association. What did he have to say?
NFL Players Association is all for this change. You know, the lawmakers in the NFL Players Association say it's a matter of safety, but it's a workplace safety thing because, you know, the question was asked, if you're going to push this bill, why not push this sort of bill further and bring it to colleges and high schools? Because notably, Ohio Stadium, where the Buckeyes play, that's synthetic turf and college players are playing on that. So why not be concerned about them? But lawmakers defended it that this is a starting point and that these are professional athletes and they deserve a safe workplace just like anybody else.
Isn't one of the lawmakers who sponsored this bill the owner of a lawn care business? Does he think that could be a conflict of any kind?
Yes. So Representative Rodney Creech, he is the Republican sponsor of this. And I asked him about that at the news conference because that was something that had circulated. You know, he owns this lawn care business. He's owned it for 2 decades now. And it's not just taking care of residential lawns. They've extended to commercial lawns, including athletic fields. But, you know, he told me he was really glad that I asked the question. He said he promised in front of all the media who were at this press conference that he'd never put in a bid for one of these associated projects if it passes. And he says, you know, professional teams really already have their who they want to pay to do these things in mind. So he doesn't even, you know, he's kind of insinuating he doesn't even really think he'd be part of the conversation. And he said something interesting. He said, you know, quote, "I would much rather the doctors in the legislature handle health bills. I would much rather the education people handle education bills, and I'll take care of the turf bills." So I thought that was interesting. This is his area of expertise. He's done lawn for 20 years, and he says it's something he's passionate about.
So what's next with this? You mentioned that, you know, the end of the General Assembly is coming soon.
So it is likely that this bill, I believe, will get at least one hearing. There's a deadline that you have to file bills by to kind of get a promised first hearing in the least. So lawmakers are not expected to come back before the November election. Many of them are defending their seats right now, so they're focused on that. They'll be back in November for what's called lame duck. So I'm sure this will have at least one hearing during lame duck. But I think in the interim, the conversation's out there now because the bill's been introduced. I'm sure the Cincinnati Bengals, if they haven't already, are probably trying to have conversations with lawmakers about how to move this forward because sometimes these sorts of things, you know, get solved without legislation, you know, once the conversation happens. And that's something that Creech said. He said, you know, I'd be open to having conversations about how to make this work without doing it legislatively. I think it's a problem. And if legislation has to be the solution, legislation has to be the solution.
Okay. Well, I also want to ask you about an Ohio Supreme Court ruling from last month that's gotten a lot of attention. It's about whether boneless chicken wings can have bones in them. Tell us about that case.
Yeah, so it's a really interesting case, and it's been kind of making its way through the courts, and the Ohio Supreme Court was probably going to be the last stop for this case. But essentially, there was a man. He was eating at a restaurant in Ohio, and he was eating boneless wings. And I should say that the Cincinnati Enquirer did an excellent story telling his side of the story. He's finally speaking out publicly after going through this case. But he was cutting up his wings, his boneless wings, and eating them. And there was a wing that got a bone that from the wing that got lodged in his throat. It caused, you know, he tried to choke it up. He tried to spit it out in the bathroom. He didn't know what had gone down his tailpipe. But he ended up having, you know, serious injury from this. It caused an infection. He was in the hospital. He's had lasting effects. So he said, you know, how can you name something boneless and then have bones in it? And, you know, it's made its way through the courts, but the Ohio Supreme Court says that boneless wings are a way of preparing wings, and that because boneless wings come from chickens, and chickens have bones, you should reasonably expect that you might find a bone in your wings, and you should guard yourself as a consumer against it. So it's providing a lot more protections for restaurants like this restaurant that served the boneless wings. And it does provide a little bit less protection for consumers who potentially get injured, like this man.
Yeah. Democratic State Senator Bill DeMora spoke out against this ruling.
I don't know how any person with common sense or common knowledge or any kind of logic can determine that something that says boneless could have a bone in it.
And Sarah, as you mentioned, the man who ate this boneless chicken wing, and that was in Greater Cincinnati where this happened, that contained a bone. From that Inquirer story, it sounds like he continues to suffer from some really serious problems, and he wanted his case to be heard by a jury. It sounds like that won't happen because of this ruling, and that was one of the concerns that Senator DeMora raised, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And because the Ohio Supreme Court has issued this decision in the way that it has, it won't move further at this point. And, you know, I think it's reasonable to expect just because of, I mean, think about how the public response to this story has been. So many people, like Senator DeMora, have said, "What do you mean boneless wings aren't boneless?" I think it's reasonable to expect that this man, if he was able to go in front of a jury and tell his story, there's probably a chance, a good chance maybe, that the jury would side with him. And so I think that you know, it's I gotta say, from a personal level, I feel for the man. He's got a strong story, and he has. I mean, it's not just he was just throwing these wings back carelessly. I mean, it was just kind of a freak thing that really did cause serious injury.
Yeah, that Inquirer story, he and his wife were quoted as saying the bone was kind of folded in half, and they've gotten so many mean comments from people about his situation. I certainly hope he gets some health relief from all this.
Absolutely. And I think it does speak to just how politicized everything has become, because it is something that Democrats say they're going to, you know, make as part of their campaigning this fall. You know, there is a seat open on the Ohio Supreme Court. You know, it's a 4-3 Republican majority, and Democrats say they're going to make this part of their case, that the Republicans who, you know, it was Republicans who found, who issued this ruling about the boneless wings. Democrats say, well, you know, Republicans are the one who say that boneless wings can have bones in it. So it's, I mean, it's just, it also really does show how politicized things have become, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking with Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Thank you so much for your time today, Sarah. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we'll hear what Cincinnati's mayor thinks about a proposed income tax increase. This is Cincinnati Edition. Mayor Aftab Purval is finally talking about the possibility of new taxes. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A group of business, civic, and community leaders called the Futures Commission released a final report in April with recommendations the group says will put the city on firmer financial footing. Mayor Purval convened the group in 2022, but he hasn't said much about the recommendations until now. Joining me in this recorded interview to discuss the mayor's take on the commission's recommendations and some other news from the past week is Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Welcome back, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lucy.
Well, thanks for being here. You talked with Mayor Purval about the final report issued by this Futures Commission and the recommendations that included increasing the city's earnings tax. Does the mayor support a tax increase?
Yes, he does. He supports all of the elements of the tax increase. There's several different parts of it. One part is a 0.1 percentage point tax increase, and that would be, you know, aimed at attracting business and investment through the Port Authority, acquiring more, you know, vacant or underutilized industrial land. And another part of that is they would, you know, fund the Lincoln and Gilbert program, which is designed to double the number of minority-owned businesses in the city. And then there is another part that would increase the amount of affordable housing and do more mixed use development in neighborhoods. So that's all in that first 0.1 percentage point income tax increase. The other part that the Futures Commission recommended was a 0.05 percentage point income tax increase to fund police and fire, to add more funding. And basically, I think that will help the rest of the general fund budget, which is facing deficits, not very big ones in the immediate future, but down the road, much bigger deficits. And so he supports all of that.
And am I remembering correctly that this commission wants these to be tax increases with an expiration date?
They do. They want it to last about 10 years. And I asked the mayor about that specific provision. I was like, do you really believe that these will be temporary? We've seen so many taxes billed as temporary. Throughout my career, no matter where I am, they'll say something's temporary, and oftentimes it will not be in the end. And he said, you know, he wasn't sure. I mean, he said, I think so. The direct quote was, I think so. I'm hopeful that once it's instituted and successful, people will see the huge investments and huge positive change, but it will be on the elected leaders in 10 years. So he's basically saying, I intend it to be temporary, but what happens in 10 years will be out of my control.
Yeah, that makes sense. This report also recommends instituting a fee for residential trash collection. What did the mayor say about that?
He's opposed to that for now. I think the gist that you get from him, I think, is that it's a very unpopular idea. I did press him a little bit on this because if you live in a residential building that's more than four units, if you're an apartment dweller and either your landlord is paying for trash or you are paying for the trash, you have to pay a trash fee. You have to contract out to get trash to your apartment or your condo, because years ago the city ended trash pickup for everybody, and they've limited the free stuff to single family homeowners. And he kind of dodged that question. He did leave open the idea of doing it way down the road, but for the immediate future, he's not in favor of it.
Well, and this talk of increased taxes comes as so many homeowners are reeling from property tax increases, and it's right on the heels of the sale of the Cincinnati Southern Railway. During that campaign, the mayor made kind of a no new taxes promise. Did he address that with you?
He didn't. And to be clear about that, and I asked him about this back when that campaign was going on, the no new taxes pledge was limited to things having to do with infrastructure. Basically, what they were saying, and I think this is true, is that the railway sale was only going to cover the city's massive infrastructure deficit, which is in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And they were not making a no new taxes pledge when it comes to, the city's operations. And I think the important thing to understand here is that most of this tax increase, two thirds of it, is not going to city government. It's not going to basic services. It's going to this business development idea, affordable housing, and, other things that the business community has said should be a city priority. And back when the Futures Commission came out, their argument was, well, we shouldn't just save, the city's budget. We should do stuff that, should help growth. And I kind of asked him about the philosophy there. I was like, why should people reach into their pockets to pay for the Port Authority to buy more land or to help more businesses and all of that? Why is that now the purview of the city? And his response was interesting. He said, the city is bigger, this is a direct quote, than trash pickup and snow plowing. That is our number one priority, but people come to us all the time asking about the fact that they can't find housing, they can't find a good job with a good business. People expect us to lead on these issues that we don't necessarily control.
Do you think the average voter understood that no taxes pledge as being a no new taxes for capital improvements versus operating budget pledge?
I don't know. I don't, there may not have been, they may not have read the fine print on that one. That's for sure. And I'm sure that the campaign, I remember the campaign was, did not, add that part to the next sentence overtly in some of the advertising. So, yeah, I mean, if people view it as a broken promise, they're going to view it that way. But factually, I do not believe it is one.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. Didn't the Futures Commission describe these recommendations, this final report, as something the city would need to adopt in full? It wasn't really presented as a menu of options, but as a, hey, you need to do all these things to solve these problems. I guess I'm wondering if the mayor thinks the earnings tax increases are needed, but he opposes a new garbage fee. Can he get the support of the business community who was involved in this Futures Commission?
Yeah, I asked him that, and he said, I don't know. He said, I'm forever grateful for the business community for leaning in. They'll have to answer that question. So he's basically punting it back to them. But it is true that he does not favor all of the stuff in the plan. He kind of said, well, we need to study the other major item here that other than the tax increases is the spinoff of the water department, which likely is going to require rate increases, which is another increase in costs on people. And so he kind of said, well, what they really said was we should study this. And that's what we're going to do is study the spinoff of the water department. The regionalization of it is what they call it. And so, it's an open question. I don't know if it's quite a game of chicken yet, but because it doesn't sound like this is going to be imminent. It doesn't sound like they're going to try to go to the ballot this November for this. So I think we'll have a rolling discussion between him and the stakeholders in the Futures Commission about whether or not, they're going to do some of the other stuff.
Well, that was going to be my next question for you, because we had Cincinnati City Council member Jeff Kramerding on the program earlier this week to talk about these recommendations. He said City Council will not be trying to put an earnings tax increase on the November ballot. Does that line up with what you heard from the mayor?
Yeah. And the mayor wasn't real specific about when it could go to the ballot. I think one of the interesting questions here is, if it's not 24, is it 25? And that is a time when both he is on the ballot for reelection, as well as all nine council members. And so that creates an interesting political situation, because they would all be on the ballot at the same time, and opponents, you know, who might be motivated to run against them and make an issue of both the tax increase and their presence on council might say, hey, look, you know, if you don't want this, you can vote me in and vote this thing down. And that sometimes can be a pretty politically potent message. So I'll be interested to see whether they take the risk of doing it in 25, given that that election and what's on the ballot that year.
Do you have a sense for whether a majority of council members would support putting an earnings tax increase on the ballot?
I do not. I have not polled all nine of them.
Okay. What's next with this report? Has the city manager issued her analysis of all the recommendations yet?
Not yet. That's apparently coming soonish. I don't know if it'll be by the end of the summer or not, but we think it's coming soon. And she did kind of a overview, a verbal thing, you know, about a month ago or so. Wasn't, you know, the flavor of that was interesting, because there was so much of a, you know, kind of a through line of, hey, we're doing a lot of this stuff already. And I'm a little bit skeptical of that. You know, there are some major savings proposed, you know, by selling assets, or, you know, the Futures Commission believes those assets will be sold. I think that there will be savings if they're sold. I think the city administration might have a different view on some of those things. So, you know, it remains to be seen. I think one of the biggest fears the business community should have had in embarking on this, and realizing that it's not just the business community, was labor on this commission, as well as some civic leaders, is that City Hall would take this and take a look at it and say, well, yeah, this is great, let's do this tax increase, and kind of brush off or minimize some of the other recommendations, which are significant, particularly the sale of the water department.
Yeah. Well, let's switch gears and talk about the race for the first congressional district. That's where U.S. Representative Greg Landsman, a Democrat, is trying to win a second term. He's running against Orlando Sanza, a Republican. Tell us how each candidate is doing with fundraising.
Well, Congressman Landsman has raised a lot of money for this race. So far, he's raised about $2.5 million for it. And he's, you know, as of June 30th, when they had to file their last reports, he had about $2 million on hand. His Republican opponent, Orlando Sanza, he raised about $470,000 and has about $245,000 in change left over. So that's a significant gap. And it kind of, you know, raises a little bit of a question as to how competitive this race will be.
Is this race getting any attention from House Republicans?
This race, no. They did announce a list of young guns, which, you know, we kind of typically view as their targets, the seats in the House that they view as being best able to switch from Democrat to Republican. Orlando Sanza was not on that list. So he is, you know, he's not at the top tier at this point.
What did the two candidates have to say to you about their fundraising and where things stand?
Yeah, Sanza kind of brushed off this, you know, appearance or not appearance on this list. He said, well, you know, you get on one list, you may not appear on another. He did say that, you know, his fundraising has taken a little bit of a boost since the Joe Biden debate performance late in July. I guess we're in August now, late in June, excuse me. And the fundraising picked up. He didn't provide any numbers to kind of back that up. So we'll see when the next reports are filed. Landsman, you know, he kind of went right at it. He said, well, you know, look, Orlando's really struggled. And he, you know, he feels like, you know, he's kind of, I think, in the catbird seat here in terms of this race. You know, hard to remember, because Landsman has been kind of all over the place since he became a congressman. He's been very active, which is what you would expect from a first-term congressman, knowing that he's facing a re-election race. But this is a potentially competitive district. The Cook Political Report says that on average, it's about a, you know, the Democrats have about a 2 percentage point advantage. So it's not completely out of the woods to suggest that the Republicans could be competitive here. But I think as of now, it's not a hugely competitive race. And we'll see if that changes.
Well, and even with the lopsided fundraising numbers right now, there's always a chance some outside group could kind of swoop in and infuse a lot of money into the race, isn't there?
Absolutely. And there's been a little bit of that on Sons's side, but not very much. But yeah, if, you know, what happens typically sometimes is, you know, late in the election season, September and October, things look like they tighten up and outside groups come in and they can dump millions of dollars into a race and basically eliminate Landsman's advantage overnight. That's kind of how our campaign finance system works. And so if the national environment takes a turn, as it did last month when after the Biden debate performance, the Democrats were very concerned about, you know, Biden taking down their House and Senate candidates. And so I suspect some of that has kind of ratcheted back with Kamala Harris being at the top of the ticket. I think Landsman feels pretty good about that. And so I think he's a little bit less worried than he may have been prior to Biden's dropping out of the race.
Well, speaking of Congressman Landsman, he was at an event to talk about the reimagining of Central Parkway. Tell us about that project.
Yeah, what they're trying to do on Central Parkway is, you know, basically it's a two-part thing. You know, you're going to, the city and the partners who are interested in this are going to redo the streetscape and make it a lot prettier and more pleasant to be on as a pedestrian or a bicyclist. And they're narrowing the street to one traffic lane. They'll still be parking on both sides of the street, it looks like. And the hope is that by making it a more pedestrian-oriented, pleasant place to be, that they will spur a lot of private investment in the street. And so the congressman was announcing the federal government had given will give $4 million in federal funding for the project. And so that's supposed to jumpstart it. So he was there, FC Cincinnati co-CEO Jeff Birding was there, and they were kind of touting, you know, what potentially is going to happen there.
What's the estimated cost of the entire project?
Well, that's a good question. That was a little bit of a moving target on earlier this week. Previously, it had been $15 million, and before that, it had been $20 million. But Landsman said, you know, they think it's kind of up in the air as the city completes its work designing this project. And so it's unclear exactly how much it's going to cost. The first, they're only doing one phase at this first point, which is between Ezra Charles Drive and Liberty Street. And so that's the first phase of it. And they hope to do future phases further down the street.
With the price tag being kind of unclear, is it clear how much money the city has for the project at this point?
I'm not sure how much the city has. I think that they, you know, they're going to have to come up with quite a bit on their own. And there's one thing that Birding said was that Carl and Martha Lindner are going to kick in for what he called some of the bells and whistles for the project, and that they could have some additional private investment for it as well. But the city's going to be responsible for the road, the utilities, the sidewalks, the trees, those types of things, as it typically is for these projects.
How big a difference could this make for this part of downtown?
Well, I mean, remember, we did a cover story maybe a year or two ago, and they were basically, you know, the folks on the street who have really pushed this were comparing it to Paris. We've all seen that this week with the Olympics, the major street there with the arch, whose name I cannot remember at the moment.
The Champs-Élysées.
Yes. Well, and you pronounced it way better than me, Lucy.
Merci.
Yes. And Birding likes to compare it to the Wharf, which is in D.C. It's a kind of a multi-billion-dollar mixed use area. And it sits kind of right near the Potomac River. And he, you know, remember that FC Cincinnati has a major mixed use development that it wants to build at the corner of Liberty and Central Parkway. And their hope is that that is, you know, really a signature project for the region.
I've been talking with Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thanks so much for your time today, Chris. Hope you have a great weekend.
You too, Lucy. Thanks.
Up next, we'll learn about the Cincinnati Olympian who made history in Paris 100 years ago. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Many of us have been riveted by the 2024 Olympic Games in Paris, maybe hoping for our favorite hometown athlete to win a medal. Today, we're going to hear about an Olympian with Cincinnati roots who made history in Paris 100 years ago. But first, we're going to discuss a major change in the way many Ohio children will be learning how to read. Joining me now are the Ohio Newsroom reporters and producers extraordinaire, Aaron Gottsacker and Kendall Crawford. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Kendall, this is the first school year for the state of Ohio to require all districts to use instructional materials aligned with the science of reading. Explain briefly what the science of reading is.
Yeah, it's a really like fancy word, I feel like, and it's really a umbrella term, so it refers to decades of research into what the evidence-based practices are for teaching kids to read, and those are primarily phonics-focused. And so it's not just one piece of curriculum, it's a bunch that fall under this wide category under the science of reading.
Okay. And have a lot of school districts in the state already been using this approach? I think many teachers in Cincinnati public schools are using it. How common is it for teachers to be using this?
Yeah, it's pretty common. So a survey from the Ohio Department of Education and Workforce showed that about one third of school districts were completely aligned. All of their curriculum matched up with this. The state has 15 curriculum that they want to see in the core curriculum. And a third of districts have that. Another third are only kind of partially aligned, and another third are not aligned and will have to do an overhaul kind of their ELA curriculum.
Okay. And Ohio Governor Mike DeWine really pushed hard for this requirement. Why did he argue this was needed?
Yeah, I think the argument is that if you are doing decades and decades of research, that is going to be the evidence-based practice, and that is what's going to work. And it's particularly a ban kind of on other methods, one of which is referenced a lot, is called three cueing. And that method is asking students to kind of look at the sentence and use context clues to try to figure out what a word might be in that sentence. And DeWine has argued that that does not work, and so he does not want to see that in the curriculum anymore.
And there were some kind of unfortunate test score results, too, for students, right? Did he push and say, hey, we need to do better on this?
Yeah, it really stemmed from the fact that Ohio's not meeting a lot of the literary benchmarks, particularly around 40% of third graders are at the correct proficient reading level that they need to be in that grade. And so that has really stemmed not only Ohio, but a lot of states to kind of look at how to increase or better their curriculum. And the science of reading has been the solution for many.
I know lots of other states have passed laws like this, too. There's a lot of information about that in your story that's on our website, WVXU.org. What kind of backlash has there been?
Yeah, well, in Ohio, there has been some backlash, including a lawsuit. Reading Recovery Council of North America has sued the state for, they say it's an unconstitutionally vague ruling to not allow other literary methods in the classroom. And then teachers groups have kind of just spoken out and said, well, we don't want to be limited. You know, three cueing or literary balanced methods might work better for some students, and to take away a tool from teachers can be kind of difficult. So both the Ohio Education Association and the Ohio Federation of Teachers, when this mandate first came out, kind of expressed they're really excited that there's being an investment in literary reform, but they don't want to see any methods explicitly banned.
Sure, because you talked to teachers who said it's a hard thing to do to teach a kid how to read.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I talked with some educators in Toledo, and they just really emphasize that the science you need to teach this and just the forethought that goes into it, it's a lot of work. And at Toledo Public Schools, where I talked to, they were fully aligned, but that didn't mean they weren't done preparing for the school year.
Sure. Okay, Aaron, I want to come to you and talk about this Olympian from the past. Many of us have been watching the Summer Olympics. You took a look back in history at an Ohio man who took part in the 1924 Paris Olympics. Tell us a little bit about William DeHart Hubbard and how he got started in sports.
Yeah, it's hard to believe this was 100 years ago, but William DeHart Hubbard, he was a Cincinnati athlete. He went to Walnut Hills High School here in our city, and he was just a star athlete there. He played football and baseball, but he really excelled at track and field. And so from Cincinnati, he went on to the University of Michigan, which we'll have to forgive him for.
Yeah, that's okay.
But he qualified for the Olympics in Paris in 1924, and he did great there. He became the first Black athlete to win an individual Olympic gold medal.
Wow. And he was one of the very few Black athletes on the U.S. Olympic team that year, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was one of just four Black athletes.
Here's what Ken Blackwell, who is this gentleman's nephew, Ken Blackwell, people might remember his name. He's former Ohio Secretary of State. Here's what he told you about his uncle's journey to the Olympics and what he was told when he got there.
One of the keepsakes of our family was a photo of him on the ship going from the U.S. to France. And it always was interesting to hear what his experience was on that ship, you know, how he had to practice, that he was in the bow of the boat. It was sort of almost an apartheid. The Hispanic athletes were a couple of levels up, and he spent a lot of time with them. And unfortunately, when he got to Paris, the International Olympic Committee told him that the 100 was still a white-only event. And so he didn't get to compete.
Well, he did compete in the long jump. You already told us he got a gold medal. It was a big deal, wasn't it? I mean, he just had an amazing performance.
Yeah, he jumped more than 24 feet. So that's really far.
A lot farther than I can jump. I just like to put that out there.
Yeah, me too. But it was a little tough because he was not able to compete in a couple of the events that he qualified. At least that's what Ken Blackwell told me.
Yeah. And here's William DeHart Hubbard in a 1970 interview from the University of Michigan archives where he talks about breaking down barriers.
As you know, there have been two activities that have contributed a whole lot to racial understanding. One is sports.
Now, after William DeHart Hubbard won this gold medal, he later set a world record in the long jump. And you noted that not long after that, he set this world record, but Jesse Owens broke the record. And here's what Ken Blackwell told you about that.
He always knew that his record was set to be broken when Oklahoma State rededicated the track. That's the Jesse Owens track. Jesse Owens was deceased, but his wife was there. And she told me that my uncle was one of Jesse's heroes. That just meant so much. You could see that continuum of attitude and determination to be better.
This is just such a terrific story. I'd urge everyone to read it on our website, listen to the audio that you put together on WVXU.org. What made you interested in telling the story of William DeHart Hubbard? Why'd you think, hey, let's go back 100 years? I mean, that's a long time to look back.
Well, I think this is a really important part of history. I mean, if you're watching the Olympics like I am, you're seeing Simone Biles, Sha'Carri Richardson race today. And William DeHart Hubbard, he was the first, right? He kind of started this legacy that's really continuing strong today.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's a very proud legacy for his whole family based on what Ken Blackwell had to tell you.
I would say so. And it was really neat to hear Ken Blackwell reminiscing and telling us about his story.
Yeah. What did you kind of take away from your reporting about this Olympian who competed and succeeded, you know, so long ago?
That's a good question, Lucy. I think that this Olympian from Cincinnati worked really hard. He had to overcome a lot of barriers to get to the Olympics that, you know, most of us might not have to think about today. He was on the ship headed to the Olympics the boat was segregated. And then he got there and found out he couldn't compete in a couple of the events that he actually qualified for. So I think, you know, his hard work is a lesson that we can take away, but also the fact that he had this attitude that records are meant to be broken. And that's what is happening today and what we're seeing happen as we watch the Olympics.
It had to have been so frustrating to make that journey, to know that you were one of the best at these events in the world and then not be able to compete. Did Ken Blackwell talk to you at all about that? I mean, it sounds like there's so much pride in the family about what this gentleman did, but there had to have been some frustration. I mean, heck, I'd be angry if that were me.
I think I would be too. And you know, he didn't find out till he got there. That's what it sounded like to me from Ken Blackwell. He qualified for the hurdles and the 100 meter dash, and you know, that would have been really cool to compete in, but he just didn't get the opportunity, all because of the color of his skin.
Yeah.
So it is nice to see that the Olympics, luckily, have come a long way in the past 100 years.
Yeah, one would certainly hope in 100 years. Yeah. What, you know, you mentioned that you've been watching the Olympics. I think so many of us have. You look back in time to learn more about this story. I want to talk a little bit more about what William DeHart Hubbard did after the Olympics, because he continued to kind of lead a life of service, didn't he?
Yeah, he really did, especially in the sports area, not surprisingly.
Yeah.
He founded the Cincinnati Tigers, which is a professional baseball team, which played in the Negro American League. And then in 1942, he moved to Cleveland, so still in Ohio, and he served as the racial relations advisor for the Federal Housing Authority. Ken Blackwell told me he was a big believer in creating an opportunity society. So, you know, he said not everyone might win first place, but everyone should have the opportunity to do so.
Yeah. And we actually want to hear that just from Ken Blackwell. So let's hear exactly how he told you all about that.
What I love about the Olympic Games and what I think it still underscores is meritocracy. You win a race because you merit that win. My uncle was a big champion in saying, we must make sure that every American has an opportunity to do his or her best. That doesn't necessarily mean that they will always come in first place, but they must have an opportunity.
So much inspiration in that quote, huh?
I know. I love it.
Yeah. Well, this has been wonderful. Thank you both so much for being here. I've been talking with the Ohio Newsroom reporters and producers, Aaron Gottsacker and Kendall Crawford. Can't wait to see what y'all have coming up next for us. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to tune into our programs next week. On Tuesday in particular, we're going to have a show that's dedicated to all the new stuff happening in Cincinnati Public Schools for this new school year. You will not want to miss it. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.